The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook if you sign up for a two-week trial of their service. Audible has 40,000 titles available to download. For all the details, follow the links at guardian.co.uk/audible.
Football Weekly Extra.
Today, Bale Force, Baleissimo, Bale Bondsman. Yes, it's the Gary Bale bandwagon and we're on it. Saluting Spurs for their brilliant destruction of Inter and asking if Big Gareth is like leather trousers. Great for scoring in Europe, at home, not so much. Elsewhere, there's wins for Man United and Chelsea, defeat for the Gunners at Wax Tap Donetsk. What will it mean for their clash on Sunday with football's other big Bale threats, Newcastle? There's Milan Real Madrid, we hear from Sid, possibly the real one, on Mu's return to the San Siro, and how Super Pippo really is football. Hard man of Twitter, Raphael Honigstein, gives us his suave but steely perspective, and there's Paul Doyle on Atomique Olympique, and why Mario Balotelli is his new favourite player. All that plus posts and the build-up to all the big games around the continent this weekend in today's Football Weekly Extra. In the pod today, Captain Sean Ingle.
Hello, James.
Ahoy.
I must correct you, though, on your leather trousers gag.
Oh.
Because I was reading in my Guardian last week that they're actually really in and trendy at the moment.
Right. Okay, thanks, Sean. Raphael Honigstein.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Nice to see you back. Lots of posters inquiring as to your whereabouts, whether you'd move to do Austria again.
No.
As you won't.
I'm back.
All right. And Paul Doyle in the house.
Hi, James.
But not literally the house, of course. But although you are sometimes. Good midweek of games, Yeah? He said controversially, because there are those out there who say that it's all a bit of a... what, Raphael? You know what I'm talking about.
I find people complaining about the group stage and sort of pining for the glory days of the knockout rounds.
Yep.
Either too old to remember the bad old days of the knockout rounds, or too young to have ever seen them.
What, when you say the bad old days, what kind of thing are you talking about?
Well, it's basically Marseille, Gilina 7-0, but times 20. With the other half of the games being dead rubber. So it's the other thing when people complain about dead rubber, they don't realise that in knockout rounds, you put really good teams against really bad teams, half of the games are dead rubbers to begin with.
Mm. Interesting. We seem to have this conversation every year.
Yeah, and it's ridiculous because if the idea of watching Europe's best teams doesn't excite you, then maybe football isn't for you. Maybe you should be watching something else. Or if you want the upsets and the rubbish teams getting through the finals, you watch the League Cup.
Well, the point is that the people make is that there aren't enough upsets, but maybe there are. I mean, Inter, for example, this week.
If there'd be enough upsets, there wouldn't be upsets anymore, first of all. And of course, you always expect the good teams to come through.
Right.
What's wrong with that? Yeah. You want the good teams to come through. Every year you get people saying, oh, wouldn't it be brilliant if Bursaspor knocked out Man United and Gilina knocked out Chelsea? But then nobody would watch Bursaspor v Gilina in the round after. Nobody.
Right.
Apart from the respective fans.
Can I just ask, because Sean, you had your finger up for a while, but I just want to check. Is this thing about Champions League group stages, yawn, is that an English thing? Or do they say that in Germany as well?
Nobody says that in Germany. And of course, the picture is very much skewed by the fact that the English teams have, over the last few years, been very, very comfortable and have had plenty of dead rubbers. And United, for example, have developed this knack of playing only half a team and still getting through. And of course, that isn't very exciting. But you talk to fans of Roma, you talk to Juventus fans last year, if they felt that was mundane, the group stage, I don't think so.
I think there are two charges against Champions League as they stand. One is that once you get to the quarterfinals, it's generally six or seven the same teams in there. Secondly, there's the impact on the domestic leagues. You know, if you're a mid-sized European country and it's the same team getting to Champions League every single year, that team has lots of
it
money.
It engenders
It makes what's often a very vibrant European leagues turn into a procession. I mean, you never would have got PSV, I think, beating Feyenoord 10-0, back in the day. I think but there was a difference in quality between a team that regularly qualifies for the Champions League and one that doesn't,
I mean, you could argue it's had a similar impact on the Premier League, except with four teams rather than just one.
Well, of course,
but the other charge against the Champions League is that the group stages aren't interesting because the really big teams don't meet each other. And people sometimes say, well, wouldn't it be great if the stakes were high right from the beginning and two of the giants met each other in a do or die clash? But I always go back to the Napoli Real Madrid match when Diego Maradona was at Napoli and they were drawn against each other in the first round. And Real Madrid won and Diego Maradona was out of the European Cup and we never got to see him in a European Cup properly as a result of that. Under the current system, he would have played a lot more matches in the elite competition, and that would have been too...
Ideally, what you could do is just get spectators to vote on which players they'd like to see in the final and just get those players in, and then we wouldn't have any of this danger of...
The other thing is that it's been a little bit over the last few years that Champions League has suffered from the fact that Italy has basically broken down economically, and the same with Spain below Barcelona and Real Madrid, because you used to have 14, 15 decent teams, so you'd have a lot more interesting matchups in the first round. Now it's only the group that gets Real Madrid, who are not seeded amongst the top eight, that's really interesting. But that's not really a problem of the Champions League as such. It's a problem because you have less amazing teams right now because of the economic crisis.
So what we're saying basically is that, unlike the rest of the world, Champions League isn't quite perfect, but it's probably better than the alternatives. That's your contention.
The proof is in the pudding. If people wouldn't be watching it in millions, it wouldn't be valuable, and nobody would
people
want
watch
it. And
Strictly Come Dancing in millions, so
yeah,
that's true.
They do.
All right. Listen. Anyway, I did mention Spurs once or twice tentatively.
If you are a traditionalist and you think that only the champions belong,
right,
you've had the perfect game this week. You could have watched Rubin Kazan v Panathinaikos, and you don't have to bother with anything else.
Ooh!
I watched that game. God, it was dull.
Right.
The other thing with the dead rubber is what really, really gets me is that if people complain about dead rubbers, there are so many games left that actually really matter and are really interesting. They might not be with the teams that they like and support, but watch those games. If you're watching Chelsea's second team play a dead rubber, then you've only got yourself to blame. Don't blame the Champions League.
Well, anyway, Spurs, playing Champions Inter. Everybody raving. Are they raving about Bale in Germany too?
To an extent, but most people watched yet another self-destruction from Werder at the very same time. Which was another fantastic game. Just didn't see that individual brilliance that we saw at Whitehall Lane. I think that he's becoming a name, but because he hasn't played against a big German side yet. And when he played for Wales a few years ago with Germany, he was absolutely useless. It was during his dark days. So, a name in the making, but not quite familiar yet.
Is it all justified, Sean? All those
I think a lot of it is. I mean, I think what's different about Bale is there's a refreshing directness in the way he plays. It's very much, we can all identify that he runs at defenders, he knocks it past them, he beats them, he either goes for goal or crosses it. And Martin Samuel makes this point in the Daily Mail today. In a world where we're all accustomed to pro zone and 4-5-1s, it's almost like going back to the playground. I thought we should... Two things I'd say. One is that Inter surprised me the way they handled him. I'm surprised they didn't put a man on him. They didn't play Zanetti perhaps deep and then Maicon on him just to try and blunt his runs. He had far too much space down the flank. The second thing is I think people have forgotten about Luka Modric. Now, I was chatting to a couple of people at the game and they both said for the first 60 minutes he was the best player on the park. And no one's really picked up on the fact he now plays as a deep-lying defensive / central midfielder, a bit like Pirlo, and I think he's doing it really well. And while Spurs are playing 4-5-1 in Europe, but it's not like most teams. When you've got Bale, Van der Vaart, Lennon, supported by the defensive midfielders of Huddleston and Modric, it's a very aggressive, very attacking formation, and I thought they were wonderful on Tuesday night.
Modric, of course, who was the player sacrificed early on in the game at the San Siro, so he effectively and Van der Vaart both missed the first clash between these two teams. It is the big question in Italy, whether Rafa Benitez even watched that first game, why he didn't take measures. In his defence, just to say, he was missing a whole bundle of players. I mean, Thiago Motta, Cambiasso and Stankovic were all out in the midfield, which is possibly why he didn't feel he had Zanetti spare to assign to covering Bale. But Jonathan Biabiani was clearly not going to do that, and it was evident from the first minute of the game that was the case. So I think the knives are really out, slightly for Maicon, but for Benitez there's a lot of questioning of what exactly he thought he was doing.
I think it's really another case of English managers ganging up on Rafa here, because Hodgson got them involved in all this back and forth, confused him sufficiently enough to talk about priests and sugar and stuff, and didn't actually worry about the very simple fact that if you have to stop white players, you have to double up effectively, or sometimes triple up, and they didn't do that at all, which is a big, big mystery. And then by the time he did it in the second half, Inter were chasing the game and couldn't really play that way, and then they were count on the counter-attack.
Mm-hmm. Are you joking when you suggest that the reason he didn't do that is because he was sidetracked by Roy Hodgson's jibes?
In every joke, there is a kernel of truth.
Well, it is, because that's what happened to him at Liverpool, towards the end of his reign. He just got sidetracked by issues that he shouldn't have let distract him.
Mm, indeed. James Heal says, just to mention in the group that now Inter and Spurs are both tied on 7 points, Spurs ahead with a superior goal difference. Twente, who had that extraordinary 2-0 win at Werder Bremen midweek, are only 2 points behind, and they face Inter next in Milan. It'd be a very big game, that one. In the meantime, for those bored of Bale mania, James Heal says, Gareth Bale should be crowned King of Football and it should be retitled Foot Bale. I'm going to push the boat out, continues James Heal, and say, I guess Bolton will beat Spurs and Bale will be non-existent on Saturday lunchtime. Fair shout, or...?
Well, I think it is fair to say that Premier League teams haven't seen a lot more of Bale. Similar to Peter Crouch, they know a bit more how to handle him. It's a tricky one to call. As we were coming in, it was revealed that Van der Vaart will not be playing against Bolton. I wouldn't be backing Spurs. I mean, Bolton have a decent record at home. They've won one, drawn three, and they obviously lost Liverpool midweek, but that might be one to... It wouldn't surprise me if it was a draw.
Spurs have only won there once in the Premier League era. There you go.
And also their record post Champions League games this season. Spurs have won
two,
drawn one, and lost two. So it's an all right record, it's not brilliant.
The Everton draw, the Wigan defeat. Portlander says, forget Bale, Inter need to buy Phil Neville, way cheaper. It's probably a good shout there. Mm. All right, well, that's almost it for part one. We're just going to have a quick mention of the Bursaspor United. Big win that for Manchester United away to the Turkish champions. Mobbad says, Moby Bad says, that's two games in a row, folks. I think we can say Michael Carrick is back. Also, Bebe and Obertan are outstanding wing prospects. Great goal from Obertan, and Bebe with another strike.
Which was awarded to the Turkish defenders.
Oh, boo.
What a shame.
All right. They're back on top of the group, though.
I think United were very impressive that game, simply by virtue of the fact that they played half a team and looked so comfortable and in cruise control. And I think that's, first of all, I do think it takes tremendous guts to do that. Everybody would have slaughtered Ferguson if they hadn't got a result. And, they seem to be able to rotate players. Of course, nobody talks about rotation when it comes to Alex Ferguson, only when the bad foreigners do it. But they rotate players and they seem to have lose very little of their structure and the way they play, and they just grind out results, certainly in Europe, and domestically it's more problematic.
But is that one of the problems with the Champions League, that United go to the Turkish champions with a second string side, win so comfortably?
Well, you have that in the Premier League as well. No one's suggesting we close that down and make it a straight knockout tournament.
Slightly different.
Actually,
no, but that's not a problem with the Champions League, because if they met in a knockout and Bursaspor wouldn't get all these millions they get from the Champions League, they'd be even a poorer side.
Tell you what. Anything you throw at him, he's just biffing it back at us. He's like a machine. He's a bit like Chelsea. Yeah. Smooth, confident, quite continental, and pretty unflappable. So another big win, 4-1 against Spartak this time. As Sean, you were pointing out earlier, it wasn't long ago, everyone was saying, oh, this ageing team, you know. Well, Sir Alex Ferguson, I think, was pointing out the fact they've got an ageing team.
Well, I remember all the papers after Scolari was sacked, and also probably in this pod as well, people said, this Chelsea team is finished.
Finished.
There's going to have to be lots of rebuilding. And Ancelotti's come in, and I think he's done a wonderful job. He's perhaps... I don't think lots of people like Chelsea, but certainly I think people hate them less than they used to because of Ancelotti. I think the way he's transformed the way they play, they're very exciting to watch.
Has he transformed the way they play?
Well, 103 goals, was it last season?
No, they do score a lot, but were they not scoring a lot?
I think they play the same, they just play more so.
Oh, okay.
There isn't that, they didn't seem to, the old days, they'd score a couple of goals and then completely kill the game,
right.
And now they just keep on going. Okay. And well, maybe that's down...
It's transformed the way certain players play. I mean,
Malouda definitely.
Has come on leaps and bounds under Ancelotti, rediscovered his Lyon form. Anelka has been playing brilliantly well recently as well.
And he's got Anelka and Drogba playing together, which was a dichotomy. Of Lampard, Gerrard-esque.
There's definitely something that he must have brought with him from Milan in terms of the fitness and conditioning of the players, because they look a lot fitter. They can play longer in the game. And that's another reason why they keep scoring right until the end. Under Scolari, some of the senior players were famously complaining that training was too lax and they didn't feel that they were in great shape.
Right. Interesting.
One remaining project, and we can hail him as an absolute wizard if he transforms John Obi Mikel into a player that we can actually recognise what it is he does.
There speaks a man that had to write 1,600 words for The Observer about John Obi Mikel a few weeks ago.
Did you? And did you ever come to any conclusion about
what? No, he has been playing better this season. And Ancelotti is quite open about the fact that he's trying to make him a more assertive player. Because when he played for Nigeria in their youth team and they came second, I think it was second or third in the World Youth Cup behind Argentina, Mikel was voted the second best player in the tournament after Lionel Messi and was comparable to Messi in the way that he played, believe it or not. His dribbling and his passing were his outstanding attributes. It's hard to believe that now. Well, his passing, yes, because his passing, he does have a fine range of passing. He doesn't deploy it as often as his employers would like him to. Dribbling, not so much, although he is very difficult to knock off the ball because of his strength.
Pad out the first 500 words of the 1600 word article with variations on what he's actually called?
Well, I spoke to his dad, actually, or someone who purported to be his dad. I have my doubts, to be honest. But it was, he said that John Mikel Obi is how it should be correctly articulated.
Right.
And it's Mika rather than Michael.
If it was his dad who answered the phone, then you can take that
John
as definitive.
Mikel Obi. Okay. Good. Chelsea, of course, you will have noticed, are playing at Anfield this weekend, where they had a 2-0 win back in May. And they rode their luck a little bit away to Blackburn last weekend, Chelsea. But you'd still imagine them to be heavy favourites for this clash.
They are, though. They're betting even money, which I think is a reasonable bet.
Really?
Well, if you look at Chelsea,
no, I mean, I'm not saying. Yeah. I'm saying I'm surprised that they're better than
they're,
even
they're 11 to 10 on Betfair, which sort of suggests they have the bookies are going to have about 47% chance to win, and I think it's probably a bit more than that.
Oh, fascinating stuff. I was just going to say, actually, about Liverpool allowing Chelsea to play their game, etc. Having witnessed Everton barging them off the ball for 90 minutes in the derby a couple of weeks back, the prospect of Liverpool's waifs going up against the big blue machine from southwest London, I think, is a frightening one for the Merseyside.
And then they've had a day less as well to prepare because they're playing the Europa League tonight.
Well, to finish off this marathon mega part one, then, the other bit in Liverpool news right now is the fact that they've just appointed Demian Comoli of Spurs fame as their director of football strategy, is it? Yeah, a director of football, basically. He's going to be signing the players.
He is, and I think it's a good idea, and I think the director of football has a bad name in England, but if it's because the managers want to control everything. But I think for a club it makes absolute sense to have someone that looks over the longer term and brings in players that could improve in 2 or 3 years time.
And it caused a massive breakdown at West Ham and also at Spurs, where Comoli and Martin Jol, there was massive friction between them, and to a large extent was identified as one of the problems that led to them being bottom of the table with just two points from 8 games when Harry Redknapp took over.
Yeah, well, I think the structure makes perfect sense, having a manager and a director of football is responsible for recruitment, simply because a manager can't be expected to do anything, and it's slightly childish to expect it to be in any other way. But obviously, because it's a relationship, it's very important that the two people in question get on. Otherwise, it will break down. Roy Hodgson has no qualms about the appointment. He's used to doing working in under such a system in Europe. And Comoli's record of signings, although there are a few duds in there, like Ricardo Rocha and Gilberto when he was at Spurs, is pretty good. A lot of the Tottenham players who are doing so well now were signed by him. He was at Arsenal, of course, before that, and he brought in a lot of young French players. And even at Saint-Etienne, where he's just left, they had a good summer in terms of signings, not with much money, and they're in a much better position in the table than they were this time last year.
Plus, if you leave Roy to make the decisions himself, you end up with Konchesky playing.
I think he's unfairly maligned, Konchesky.
Really?
For £2 million, I think he's a pretty good fullback.
I mean, this was back in the envelope stuff, but I was chatting to a friend of mine, and we worked out that Spurs, with Comoli there, spent about £180 million
I've got 155.5 million with a recouping of 87 million from the sales of people like Berbatov, Carrick and Keane.
But that might be right, but we worked out that also be about an average of 7 million per player, which isn't exactly the sort of money ball strategy of doing things, which is buy them young and cheap and then sell them on. So it's quite interesting.
Is that a policy that can be just buy them young and then flog them? Can that be brought in at Liverpool without a big change to the way they view football?
I think it takes time, and I think there's a disconnect between what the fans will want come January, which is big name players coming in for big money, and the reality, which is actually the transfer market's probably going to be quite dead in January, and Liverpool won't have that much money.
Mm.
The impact of his arrival might well take a year, 18 months to filter through.
Excellent. That is it for part one. Plenty to come. Still, of course, as we round up the remaining excitements from the Champions League and look forward to the other big games this weekend, Sid on the line from Madrid after this.
Football Weekly Extra with James Richardson.
It's part two, listeners. Sid's on the line from Madrid. Sid, how are you?
Hi, James. I'm all right, thanks. How are you?
I'm ever so well. I saw the front page of AS this morning. It said they did it for Webb. What do they mean?
That's so very kind of them, isn't it? They had this fantastic victory. They said, we did it for you, Howard. I wonder if in the next game when Cristiano Ronaldo scores a beauty, he's going to lift off his Real Madrid shirt to reveal a T-shirt underneath saying, that's for you, Howard.
I don't get it, though. Who's they? Is it Real Madrid or Milan? Or what's the story?
No. The point of this front-page headline in AS, which is Bapporti Web, basically is, we did it for you, Web. In other words, we did it to show you. It's the equivalent of saying, have that, Howard Webb, because they feel that Howard Webb completely robbed them last night and that the equaliser was the very, very least they deserved, which actually in footballing terms, I think it probably was. And they basically decided it's a kind of in-your-face Webb, because, of course, bear in mind, not only do they feel that Webb ripped them off last night, the context of this is the World Cup final, which already meant that the Spanish were kind of waiting for a bad performance from Webb. They think he's an absolute disaster, and of course, they might not necessarily be wrong.
All right. What do they think about Super Pippo Inzaghi in the Spanish press there, Sid?
Well, a bit like most people, I think they find it very hard to like him.
Right.
And they find it very hard to warm to him. And there's one or two people, I actually listened to the radio last night, Spanish radio last night, and they were saying, there was a slight frustration because, of course, by scoring that goal, Pippo Inzaghi has gone, well, it depends, there's a bit of an argument here going on, but has gone a goal ahead of Raul or maybe gone level with Raul in terms of European goals. So there's a bit of frustration there. But more than anything else, there's just the frustration of him having turned around the game last night against Real Madrid, which Madrid felt that they had very, very definitely won.
And what do they think about Ronaldo's performance, the big crybaby rolling around on the floor with his slap face?
Is he a big crybaby rolling around the floor with his slap face? Because you wouldn't believe it reading the Spanish media this morning. Very little talk about that. In the sports media, very little talk about that indeed. There's a couple of quite nice pieces in some of the mainstream media. El País done a nice piece about it, about the fact that he was slightly caught on the top of the chest and 2 or 3 minutes later they went down holding his face. But that's there's very few accusations levelled at Cristiano Ronaldo in the sports media, the Madrid-based sports media anyway.
But what about his performance?
Really
what about his performance beyond that? The fact that he disappeared out of the game.
The fact that he was poor. Yeah, the fact that he was very, very poor. I thought it was his worst performance for a while for Real Madrid. I think one of the accusations that's often levelled at one or two of Real Madrid's other players, in particular Gonzalo Higuain, who from a certain sector of the Spanish media there's been constant attacks on him saying, yeah, but he doesn't do it in the big games. I think that's starting to become an accusation that in one or two occasions at least can be levelled at Cristiano Ronaldo. I thought he was poor last night, and it's true that on the kind of one-by-one ratings, he hasn't been particularly highly marked, but no one's come out and gone for him for this. Nobody's said, oh, well, he was rubbish or anything like that. They've preferred to focus on what was all round, I think, a really quite good performance from Real Madrid. And I think they're right when they say that justice was done with the equaliser. In fact, probably justice would have been to have beaten Milan.
Well, also because Inzaghi's second was classically, typically enough, very much offside. Real Madrid are now qualified. They topped the group with 10 points. Milan are on 5 points. Ajax only a point behind on 4 after being defeated midweek by Auxerre. Sid, listen, a couple of quick things to finish. One, it's the derby in Madrid this weekend, but maybe we can get your thoughts on that on Monday, reaction to all of that. But a lot of people commenting on that draw for Barcelona there in Copenhagen. One that we actually kind of called on the pod here back on Monday. Kayaking saying, after watching the incident with Damien, how do you say this, Paul? Is it Damien Doi?
Doi, yeah.
Yeah, Damien Doi from their game last this week. I wanted to ask, does Victor Valdez have any history in making such poor challenges? This kind of Harold Schumacher-esque knee to the face?
Mm. Well, there's a whole load of things that have come out of this game. One of them, of course, was the big set two between Solbakken and Pep Guardiola off the game. I hadn't realised that Solbakken apparently was part of the Wimbledon crazy gang side and is a bit of a wind-up merchant at the best of times. He says that Pep Guardiola misunderstood a joke that he'd made about Pinto, and that's why Guardiola was so furious, and it wasn't fair for him to be quite so furious. And then, as you say, the other big one is the Valdez challenge, Harold Schumacher challenge. And to be honest with you, James, I feel like going on a rant here because I think this is much more than Victor Valdez. I'm absolutely sick of the fact that it seems that goalkeepers are allowed to challenge in any way they like when a forward is anywhere near them. When was the last time you saw a goalkeeper go out and receive the ball and not lift his knee or his studs or try and supposedly protect himself, but it seems to me actually assault the striker? A striker goes anywhere near a goalkeeper and a foul is blown every time, and I think referees have a problem with giving offensive fouls far, far too easily. And I don't understand, because it's not just Victor Valdez. Goalkeepers are doing this all the time. Not as bad as Valdez is the other day, obviously, but the studs up or the knees up thing every time a goalkeeper goes for the ball, I just don't understand why everyone seems to think it's okay.
I don't know. Perhaps because, you know, what happened to Petr Cech, everyone feels a bit like a goalkeeper.
Of course, but he's a goalkeeper, but it doesn't mean that happens every time anyone challenges a goalkeeper.
Right.
It doesn't mean, okay, well, one goalkeeper hurt his head once. Tell you what, let's all jump with our studs up or our knees out.
Yeah, it's ridiculous, isn't it? It's ridiculous. Barcelona, anyway, remain top of their group, 1 point ahead of Copenhagen, with Rubin Kazan back on 3 points. So it's 5 behind
Barcelona.
But they're
worried about it, James. Sorry to interrupt.
No, yeah.
Barcelona are worried about this a little bit because they went into the game against Copenhagen thinking to themselves, if we win this, we're through. We've got two games we can take easily. They now have to go to Panathinaikos, I think it is, and win to guarantee qualification. Most importantly, they have to go to Panathinaikos and win and play a serious game in the build-up to the Clásico against Real Madrid. And I think that's the main reason why they're disappointed with this draw, because they wanted to get it out the way and enable themselves to prepare for that Clásico, knowing that they didn't need to play with Messi or Villa or Xavi or Iniesta in Greece. Now they probably will have to play with at least some of those.
We haven't talked enough about Pippo Inzaghi, frankly. We haven't. Front page of today's Gazetta is Real Pippo. You got to love Pippo. There he is, so weak and trembly out on the football pitch with all these big beefy chaps. And he's still 37 years of age, gets out there, lifts his team, because before he came on, Milan were going nowhere, and he scores a brace. All right, one was offside, but grumble, grumble, grumble. He scores a brace and becomes the top scorer in the European Cup ever, etc. And the best thing about it was that he actually had the jerseys prepared. So when he scored his 69th goal in Europe, he ran to the bench, got jersey with Inzaghi 69 on. But then he had a number 70 as well there. And I imagine he probably had 71, 72, 73, because this man's self-belief is enormous. 37 years of age, never gets a game, goes on the bench, but he takes a personal stock of record-breaking shirts with him, just in case.
There's hope for all of us here.
Yeah.
I found it hilarious that Mourinho, of course, pre-match said, the only player I'm worried about is Pippo Inzaghi. So being, I guess, quite honest, but at the same time, clearly patronising towards Milan as a whole, and it's backfired spectacularly.
He's the man, as Liverpool, of course, will remember 2007, the final.
What's he like as a player? You must have interviewed him over the years.
I like Pippo. I mean, he takes himself tremendously seriously. I think everybody
does
knows.
Does he groom a lot? Because he seems to be a man that kind of is conscious about his hair and everything.
As far as I know, I've never been to his place, but he lives quite a simple ascetic lifestyle. He has very simple dietary habits. He was best mates with Christian Vieri, who's, you know, nightclub frequenter numero uno. But Pippo himself was never a wild boy. And he takes diet and fitness tremendously seriously, which is why at 37 he's still able to do this kind of thing and be ready. There was a little plaintive cry from him, like after the game, Allegri must not forget me. It's very difficult. I have to feel like I'm important to this team, although it's very difficult for me to keep training at this level. I can completely understand that, but I thought it was fabulous to see him going on. Lots of posters agreeing. Super Pippo Inzaghi. I hope you're going to give a mention of my favourite player of all time. Formica Atomica. How about some Inzaghi appreciation? Also insight into the Del Piero Inzaghi relationship. Nick Greaves adding his voice to that and saying, has there ever been a more durable double act? Because Del Piero still banging them in, has just become Juve's all-time the top scorer last weekend. But Inzaghi, going back to that tremendous partnership they had at Juventus back in the late 90s, when they had Zidane behind, of course, and Del Piero and Inzaghi, and they would each pass to Zidane, but never to each other, because they patently couldn't bear the sight of each other. And those were the days of my favourite Inzaghi quote, which is when he said, "What, we're getting a violin from producer Ben?" No, I love this. When he went on a bit of a scoring drought, he didn't score for a month or two. And, people were saying, "People, what's going on with this goal drought?" And he said, "Well, if they start questioning me, that's the end of football." And I think in many ways he's right. Excellent. The other bit of Italian news, of course, Inter being defeated, was that Roma won away to Basel, and they have the derby coming up this weekend. We'll talk about that on Monday because this is a long pod already. But I noticed that Lazio have been banned from using their eagle pre-game, which I take as an omen. These things always are. I think Roma, in fact, I guarantee a Roma win.
Even without Totti?
Yeah, especially without Totti. France, good week for the French. Hey, Paul Doyle. Auxerre, Olympique, that's 7-1.
7-0.
Was it 7-0?
7-0, yeah.
Oh, poor Zelina.
Yeah. Yeah, ideal preparation for the French Classico, which is this weekend, Marseille against PSG.
Mm.
Although it wasn't a good week for one of the French teams, Lyon. And Claude Puel is in real trouble there. They were 4-0 down to Benfica, came back to 4-3, but they're not looking a good team, and they haven't been a stable team since he took over. It was difficult. He took over at a difficult time, at the period when a lot of the players who had achieved so much dominance were coming to the end of their careers. But he's been given a lot of money to invest in new players. Okay, he doesn't choose the players because they have a sporting director arrangement. But they are good players, and he hasn't got the best out of them. And sorry, you're
no. I'm doing my gangster stylings.
Right.
OM. What about OM though? That's 7-0. That's the biggest away record in the Champions League history.
Yeah.
Are they going to muller Paris Saint Germain now?
Well, they have. It seems that they've hit upon a formation and team selection that works. Although even the French media were at pains this morning to point out that they were shocked by how bad Zelina were.
Yeah.
A lot of their key players are in front. Valbuena is playing really well out in the right. Gignac, who's been low on confidence recently, hit a hat-trick, so that will obviously do him good. And he brought Benoit Cheyrou back into the team in place of the Ghanaian player, Andre Ayew Pele's son. And Cheyrou brought a dynamism that had been lacking in the midfield and helped get the ball to Lucho, who is their playmaker.
All right. And there were some doubts as well about whether the Classico or the Classique, as I imagine it might be called.
No, they call it the Classico.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
All right. About whether it be going ahead because of the ban on travelling supporters.
Yeah, Marseille threatened to boycott it because of the ban of their fans attending the match because of countless incidents of violence in the past, and they did it once before. I think it was 3 years ago.
They boycotted the match.
They didn't boycott. Well, a form of boycott. They sent their reserve team, their youths. I think it was an under 19 team, and they got a nil-all draw. And the team were greeted like they'd won the cup on their return to Marseille. Absolute heroes. But PSG are playing reasonably well at the moment, so it'll be a good match.
Not as well as Brest are playing. Bingo the dog posting in. Seen who's on top of Ligue 1. Yes, we've got Brest on show. These Brest are untouchable and they're no fakes. I know one of their supporters. He says he's a sucker for Brest. Their two strikers are quite good looking chaps. They're known as a nice pair of...
All very titillating.
I've got a Brest joke as well. Am I allowed to say it? No. All right. Oh, that's it for part two. Although I should mention, I forgot, that I scribbled a little note here, Pirlo with a big circle around it. While the Italian press is going bonkers about Pippo Inzaghi, Pirlo, what a performance from him. If you saw the game, you know what I mean. Absolutely astonishing player of the week for me. Anyway, that is it for part two. Next up, Raphael Honigstein has his say on the Bundesliga, and we address the remaining games of interest from the Premier League this weekend. Part three, Raphael Honigstein, it's Bundesliga time. I saw Borussia Dortmund play at Mainz. Mainz are rubbish at the back. What kind of league leaders are they?
They were a little bit nervous. I think that, it was the biggest game for them ever, first against second, and Dortmund pressed really, really well, and Mainz couldn't deal with it.
Mm.
Simple as that.
All right. Well, there's a six-point gap between those two and the rest of the pack. That's interesting, isn't it?
It is, because you've got all the traditionally big teams underperforming this year. Werder are nowhere, Stuttgart are nowhere, Schalke, of course, bottom of the table. Bayern are only 6th or 7th. Hamburg are punching well below their weight. So all of a sudden you've got teams like Frankfurt and Hoffenheim and Hannover doing well. But I suspect that the league, as long as it goes on, will take on a more familiar look. And already you can see Bayern now having a couple of more easy games to look out for. Gladbach away, then Nürnberg at home. They'll probably end up 4th or 5th. At worst, before the winter break.
Borussia Dortmund, who are on top now. Sorry, Sean, you wanted to...
I was going to say, if we all expect Mainz to blow up, do you think anyone can catch Borussia? Because they have a 10-point advantage over Bayern, don't they?
I mean, Dortmund is the one that they all take seriously. And even before that game, even if Mainz had won that game, I think Bayern and all the others would still be talking about Dortmund, because they have the strength, they have the reserves. Interesting enough, they play PSG, of course, on Thursday, and there is a worry for them from their point of view that being involved in Europa League will take a lot out of them, because it's a very, very young team. They play with the youngest ever team for their own club, just a tad of a 23 years old away to Mainz, which shows you just how inexperienced that team, certainly in Europe, is. And, of course, Bayern and all these other guys hope that their inexperience will catch up with them, and perhaps the ill effects of playing in midweek. But they look the real deal. I mean, they've got a fantastic mix of players. They've got all these youngsters coming through. There's a whole wave of new German players that they'll be introducing just by themselves to the national team in the next couple of months. There's Hummels at the back. There's Mario Götze, an 18-year-old who's absolutely sensational. There's Kevin Grosskreutz as well, who can come in. And they just look very, very good. And in Klopp, they have a manager who seems to be really, in a sort of a Mourinho way, having that impact to get a lot out of players very, very quickly, because already last year he did very well with them.
Oh, all right. Very interesting, very interesting. You probably wanted to talk about that Bayern Munich split, but they're all friends again now, aren't they, Uli Hoeneß and
I don't think so.
No. Does it matter? Is it one of those tiffs? Was Uli Hoeneß just a bit upset that he wasn't getting his fair amount of respect from Van Gaal, or what?
It does matter in the sense that it'll keep on bringing sort of headlines and unwanted attention and noise to a Bayern Munich side who don't really need that right now, because they're still very much playing catch up in the league, and they have a lot of injuries, and to have that extra level of stress and of aggro is unnecessary. And at the end game, of course, or the interesting thing down the line, what will happen, because there are people in the board, and certainly Christian Erlinger, the sporting director, is a big fan of Van Gaal, would love to see him stay there for a few good years and perhaps build a new era, something that hasn't really happened at Bayern since Ottmar Hitzfeld left the first time around, and give them the stability and give them that success. But if you've got a president who doesn't get on with your manager, and they don't seem to be able to reconcile the differences, they've only what they've agreed to is basically just to live with each other and don't talk. But I think it's a problem, especially if results don't go well. Then of course Hoeneß will come back and hit home some more.
Very interesting. So all right, well, we'll keep an eye on that. In the meantime, moving on in this part three to the rest of the weekend's action in the Premier League. Bolton Tottenham on Saturday, we talked about that already. Birmingham are taking on West Ham, who are, of course, bottom of the table. Big game in the relegation area for Blackburn and Wigan. Blackburn are third last, Wigan fourth last. Wigan have never won at Rovers. And Rovers, as we were mentioning before, playing bravely against Chelsea without getting any real reward for it. So, yeah, could be a tough game there. Blackpool, who were fortunate on Monday to get that win against West Brom, are hosting Everton, who haven't lost in four and are now only 4 points off the Champions League positions. Fulham, Aston Villa, also on Saturday, as is Man United against Wolves. Man United still unbeaten in the league. Wolves, you saw them actually, Paul, pulling off that victory over Man City. Can they do it again? Well, against United, another team from Manchester.
Yeah, possibly, because I also saw them the previous week against Chelsea, and they were very good in that match and were quite unlucky not to beat Chelsea. It was just bad finishing that let them down. And they were excellent against City. And Stephen Hunt made his first start, I think, since signing for them, and which means they have good threats on both wings because Matt Jarvis is in brilliant form for them.
Matt Jarvis.
Yeah.
Yep.
Sorry, Raf.
No, I don't want to interrupt you.
But now that you have.
I was wondering if Danny Murphy did him a massive favour by pointing out the fact that they were very physical, because ever since he's done it, they decided to play more football.
Well, see, I don't think that's true. I don't think Danny Murphy was the only one pointing that out either. I think a lot of the slating they got was unjustified. It was, a lot was extrapolated from a couple of samples, admittedly quite incriminating samples. But generally, Mick McCarthy has always cultivated a nice, tidy, dynamic style of play. And they've been doing that since last season. They've added a little bit of quality to it this season. And the players, most of this team are the team that came up from the Championship, with a few exceptions such as Kevin Doyle and the like. But they have grown into the Premier League, and it's really impressive that the way individually as well as collectively they've evolved as a team. And although they're in the relegation zone at the moment, I expect them to be comfortable come the end of the season.
Oh, all right. But you think they have a chance of getting something at Old Trafford?
I do. I mean, United are obviously favourites because they've got more quality in the team. But Wolves are a serious opposition to anyone.
All right. Well, Liverpool-Chelsea we talked about before. On Sunday, Arsenal take on Newcastle. Now, Newcastle played Arsenal not so long ago in the League Cup, and we're at the wrong end of, what was it, 4-0? 4-0 defeat. Theo Walcott looking amazing. Bentner looked pretty good. I was just interested with Arsene Wenger's comments that Walcott might be the new Thierry Henry, who likewise was a wide kind of attacking midfielder type player before Arsene Wenger got his hands on him, if you remember. So is that a credible theory from Le Prof?
I think you'd have to change the formation that he's currently playing. I mean, because Walcott, he doesn't have the strength are now to play the role that Shamak is playing, for instance, at the moment, as a kind of fulcrum that brings in the trio of attacking midfielders just behind. So maybe play two up front or something. But I suggest at the moment, Walcott wouldn't get into Arsenal's best 11. He's use him as an impact substitute.
Well, I do think Walcott is really instrumental, because not only does it give him that pace that they don't really have, but also he looked so good in the first few rounds that I think Arsenal as a team had a belief that they could actually do something this year. And I think in that sense, it's important for him to come back, because Van Persie, who's the other, I would say, singly most important player, is still out, even though the Dutch have picked him for the national squad, which is hilarious. And Wenger's very upset about this.
Mm. Is there a case for making a kind of Arsenal Wizard of Oz style parallel, in which you would have Walcott would be the scarecrow because he doesn't have a footballing brain, and then there's various other ones that don't have a heart, probably. You know your Arsenal players better than either, but yet as a band it works together, and together they go down the yellow brick road of the Premier League. I'm just throwing that out there. You can take that one away and work with it a bit. And who is the Wizard of Oz? Is Le Prof the man behind the curtain? I don't know. Something for listeners to work on in their quiet moments before we next speak. In the meantime, West Brom hosting Man City. West Brom beat Man City at the Hawthorns, when was it? In September, in the League Cup. And City have lost their last two games. This one's got home win written all over it. Hey, Paul Doyle.
I don't know. I'll be particularly interested in seeing Mario Balotelli.
Yes.
Because I saw him for the first time in the flesh last week, and I was greatly entertained.
Mm.
For the first 15, it was his first start for City, I think. And for the first 15 minutes, he looked absolutely brilliant. Everything he did just radiated class. His touch and his movement were excellent. And the Wolves defenders twigged it very quickly. And they converged on him in huge numbers every time he got near the ball. And there was real panic in their defence and a sense that anything could happen. Then after about 15 minutes, he got a bang on the knee. It wasn't a bad tackle, but it was just slightly awkward. And he got a bang on the knee, and I think it was the same knee that has been injured for the last few months and that has delayed his debut. And his mood completely changed. And for the remainder of the match, he was like that angry bloke you see in some pubs going around looking to start fights.
Barry Glendening.
He was just squaring up to people, swiping little sly swipes at people. And interestingly, because he just had completely lost it. His performance deteriorated really badly. But with the last 15 minutes, when City obviously needed a goal to at least equalise, Mancini took off Adebayor, who had been playing quite well, rather than Balotelli, who had been doing nothing, as I say, for the last hour. And a lot of attention was given to Adebayor's spat with Vincent Kompany during the game. But just after that spat, he rowed with Mancini on the sideline. And judging by the gesticulations, which is all I could go by, it seemed to be about tactics, because Mancini certainly got his tactics wrong for that match. And I wonder if that was a sign that, that there is a breakdown, or at least a frailty in their relationship, because he was taken off and replaced by Pablo Zabaleta, which didn't make any obvious sense. I asked Mancini afterwards why he did that, and he simply said, I wanted to try something different, and wouldn't elaborate.
Well, nothing wrong with wanting to try something different, Rafael.
You just sense that the City are coming into sort of a pivotal time in that season, possibly, with the Manchester derby looming large next week, and all these stories, you know, half of the team arguing with each other, the other half drinking. Mancini somewhere in the middle, not really connecting with a large group of players, I sense. I mean, you can only judge by what you hear and what is whispered. It seems sort of very evenly poised between going on this great run that they had, beginning with Tevez taking charge and leading them sort of, and you know, gripping the game by the throat, etc., or all these people squabbling and it all ending in tears.
Right.
I think the next couple of games might tell us what's going to happen.
Mm. In the meantime, I've got Dorothy as Cesc Fabregas, because he's kind of trapped in this strange, mysterious land and he's desperately trying to get back home. Toto, I'm not sure, might be Jack Wilshere, you know, because he's only little. And the Wicked Witch of the East-West.
All the
West.
Regimes who won't let Arsenal play the way they want to.
I don't know why I was going with Big Sam Allardyce, but that you can fill in as appropriate.
I've never seen The Wizard of Oz. Is that
oh,
wrong?
Oh, my goodness. Really?
Never.
Well, don't try now, because it will come across very, very strange. I've seen it quite recently, and it is pretty weird. But, but yeah. I mean, you know, it's an interesting film.
I've never watched Alice in Wonderland. Never read the
book. Well, the book's more important, I think, in that case. And, you know, some people might say the same thing of The Wizard of Oz.
Well, was your childhood just all about Shute and Roy of the Rovers?
Pretty much. I can tell you some very nerdy stories, which I won't.
Right.
But yeah, but a lot playing football, reading football, and even kind of playing Sabutio kind of sometimes by myself.
flicking off by yourself. That's enough about your childhood, I think, probably. Sean Ingram. No. Oh, dear. Right, that's it for today's Football Weekly Extra. And we'll be back on Monday with Classic Edition Football Weekly. In the meantime, many thanks to producer Ben, to Paul Doyle, Sean Ingle, and Raphael Honigstein. Look forward to seeing you all again soon. Listeners, have a super weekend. And also, don't forget that on Friday morning, there will be, assuming I can go and write it now, a quick review of what the European papers have been talking about this week. That's it for now. Bye-bye.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk and to download your free audiobook. Head to guardian.co.uk/audible.
The Guardian.